It might not be completely obvious, but I think the motivation for the kinds of things that I want to cover today are really thinking about quantum classical correspondence, and in particular, to take a certain approach to that, which seems to be becoming more popular, which is to try to put together a modern view of quantum measurement theory with considerations about nonlinear dynamics and chaos, and how such things are manifested in quantum mechanical systems, and to start to put in place maybe just a new perspective on how to approach this question of quantum classical correspondence. So this is going to combine a few different projects that are going on in my group. I'm going to start out by just giving credit that a lot of the deep thinking is done by Ramon Van Handel, who's one of the junior graduate students in the group. A lot of the numerical work that I'll be showing is actually done by Mike Arnon, who's a senior student. And sort of it's going to be funded by a number of different agencies. And the last thing to point out is that our group actually does just sit jointly between physics and a group called control and dynamical systems. So actually, a lot of the attitude in this is an engineering type attitude, which I hope will come through. And I think for us, it's been extremely productive actually to think about quantum mechanics, not necessarily as a theory about what's exactly true, but just as a theory that you can use as an engineer to try to get things done. And putting into, casting into that kind of a role as has been good for us in terms of coming up with better interpretations. So the title here is Quantum Culturing and Nonlinear Dynamics. So quantum culturing is really just, I want to introduce a certain perspective on what we mean by measurement of quantum systems, especially open dynamical systems. And then in the middle and end of the talk, I'm going to talk about applying it to systems with nonlinear dimensions. So I don't know if everybody's familiar with the notion of filtering even classically. So I wanted to start out with one slide which introduces some of the basic concepts and sort of illustrates what filtering means to a classical engineer or applied mathematician to talk about sort of what some of the tools and goals are in that field. And then in the next slide, I'll talk about quantum mechanical generalizations of the same methodology. So in filtering, what we have in mind is that there's some dynamical system, which here I've chosen mechanical systems, such as a particle moving around in a potential well. And the dynamics of this, there are some variables like a position and a velocity, and these things evolve in time either continuously or discretely according to some ordinary or even stochastic differential equation. So to plot it here is just to say that there's some potential V of x that exerts a force on the particle, but then maybe there's also some stochastic term in that comes in to drive the motion. So in particular, if you have this kind of a noisy driving term, or even if you just have some uncertainty about the initial values of these variables, you really ought to regard these things as being random variables that evolve according to this type of dynamics. Now, in the setting or overall setting of this talk, what I mean by nonlinear dynamics is simply to say that the potential that this thing moves in is more than quadratic. And so it's not just it's not a linear dynamics in that sort of mechanical sense. So now, we may have such a thing that just exists as a physical system in a laboratory, and we may have a pretty good model of exactly how its dynamical variables evolve. On the other hand, with this actual physical system, we're often unable to just simply go in and construct sensors that tell us the values of these variables at all times. I mean, often we can make some kind of a measurement, but typically, the information that we get out of a measurement is going to be something sort of partial. So let me just imagine a situation where the measurement signal that we get is, say, proportional to the velocity of the particle as it moves around its potential. And then maybe even you have to add on some sort of extra noise term, which represents the noise that fits in the sensors. So if you just imagine that this is some physical system that lives in a black box in the laboratory, and we have a model of how it evolves, but then what we have in the actual experiment is just some signal that comes out from the measuring device, and that signal is a voltage as a function of time, or something like that. We know that what it represents is a partial observation of the system, corrupted by a little bit of noise, and maybe the system is even driven by some other noise process that we're not able to observe at all. On the other hand, you get the idea that, well, if these noises are small, and even if the only thing that we get to observe is, say, the velocity, if you sit and look at the signal for long enough, you really ought to be able to construct a good picture of exactly where the system variables are on the entire phase space. Right? Because if you see the velocity oscillating for a while, then that kind of tells you that maybe you're down in this potential well or in the upper potential well. And in fact, if you just sit there and look at it, you should be able to even sort of take out modulo some symmetries exactly where the position of the particle is. Right? Such a thing, it may take a while for that statistical procedure to converge if you have lots of noises in it, but in general, you get the idea that this is something possible. And so what I think an applied mathematician or an engineer means by filtering is the construction of some sort of some set of equations, which would then be implemented by some kind of electrical circuit, which takes as its input is sort of noise-corrupted partial observation signal. So this is meant to be a real, you know, real-time observation. So the physical system is sitting there doing its thing. We have some continuous measurement signal that comes out. And the job of the filter is to take that signal and construct an optimal evolving estimate of what the values of the physical variables are. Right? And classically, at least, this is all computing all the time. And so you can view the filter as a circuit or just some computational box that takes the measurement signal as its input, and as its output, it spits out point estimates, let's say, for the values of any variables that you care about. So for instance, x, the mean value of x, the conditional expectation of x, conditional expectation of the velocity, or maybe conditional expectation of x squared or things like that. Right, so really, the thing that lives inside this yellow box, that's the thing that we talk about as being a filter. Now, there are actually many different approaches to actually constructing these sorts of equations depending on what your objectives are. If what you want to do is to construct estimates like this that are least squares optimal, so that among all functions of the output signal, you try to construct the estimates that have a minimum square distance from the actual values of the variables, then essentially what you're doing is trying to take a conditional expectation of this random variable that represents x and t with respect to the information that you got. And so doing this is actually the theory for how you do this. It's all actually completely worked out in the classical case. There is an equation or a procedure that you can write down called Fischer-Sertonin equation, which tells you how to do this in a classical setting. And then when certain simplifications can be made, for instance, when the dynamics here is actually linear, so if you have a particle evolving, for instance, in a quadratic potential, then you could get really simple equations corresponding to things like a Kalman filter, which is a very, very widely used filter in practice for things like thermostats and other sorts of real-world systems. So the context in which you might want to do this are very, very broad. So I would say the reason why a lot of this mathematical machinery got developed was for military applications such as target tracking. So the idea is something like, well, suppose that somebody far away fires a rocket, and you get to make occasional partial observations of the trajectory of that rocket. You would like to fill in the other variables to tell you what its ballistic trajectory is going to be. And you'd like to imagine that you can do that in some sort of mathematically optimal way. Another context in which this is very widely used and where a lot of the modern mathematical machinery has been developed is in mathematical finance. This is the kind of thing where, say, for instance, you're looking at the prices of stocks or of options, and you know you get to see the prices of certain things, but what we're really trying to do is estimate values of other underlying variables, a knowledge of which will help you to optimize your own investment strategy. But then for an engineer, the key application in which you want to do this kind of filtering is in real-time feedback control. So perhaps this dynamical system that you have in the laboratory is actually something that you want to try to control. Or maybe you're actually inside the black box, like it could be an airplane flying around. And so there, the idea is that based on some partial observations, which are partial just because you don't have enough sensors to measure every single variable that describes the dynamical system, you would like to come up with some sort of control policy where you change things, like you exert an extra time-dependent force on the particle, or you change something about the setting of the flaps on your wings, that allow you to achieve some sort of an objective, like steering the plane, or let's say cooling this particle down to a stationary point. And in those cases, what's most commonly done in both linear and nonlinear stochastic control is you take this output signal that you have, and you want to derive how should I change the forcing function of the particle to achieve my objectives. But you can often adopt what's called a separated design procedure, where you first take the output signal, and from it, you try to construct optimal estimates of all the variables that you actually care about. And then having such estimates, you can then go and compute a control policy, which is based on those estimates, and then use that to be the thing that applies to feedback. Okay, so there are many, many engineering applications in which you care about doing this kind of thing. And essentially, working out the optimal equations is some big, long exercise in stochastic calculus. But a lot is done in those projects. Now, in practice, the difficulty of accomplishing this sort of thing comes from practical stuff. Right? Like, if you're trying to do feedback control and estimation on an airplane, you need all of this computation to go on at a time scale which is very fast compared to the actual motion of the plane or the rate at which the winds change or anything like that. Also, being able to come up with these sorts of optimal estimates relies on having a pretty accurate model for the way that the things actually evolve inside the physical system. Right? So often you need to do this sort of thing iteratively, where you start by, say, having some initial model of how those things evolve. You construct a filter like this, say, try to control the object under question, and if your control is very bad, maybe you actually have to make some adjustments to the model that you're using to run the filter. And then, you know, finally, there are lots of challenges in this overall kind of scenario regarding how you can do these things optimally, and indeed, what you want to take as your figure of merit for that kind of optimal design. So these things become interesting for, say, a quantum optics person like myself, when you say that the physical system that you're looking at is not just like a part point particle moving around in the potential, but it's actually some sort of quantum mechanical system. And so to make a long story short, there actually is a fairly well-developed machinery of quantum filtering, which sort of sprang up in different places in the mathematical physics literature in Russia, and also sort of independently, many of these things have been invented by the quantum optics community in the Western Hemisphere. And the basic idea now is that rather than having this point particle, which evolves according to some Lagrange equations, you just say that, well, I have some quantum system, which maybe is a bunch of atoms. And these things are essentially evolving according to the Schrödinger equation. But now I have to say something about what I mean by making a continuous measurement of these things. And I think really the only thing that makes sense from an experimental perspective is to say that you implement a type of continuous indirect measurement by scattering fields off of these particles. Right, so if the atoms are sitting there localized inside a vacuum chamber, like maybe you have a bunch of cold atoms sitting in the center of my vacuum chamber, a way that I can implement a meaningful continuous measurement is to take a laser beam, shine a laser beam on the atoms, and then detect the scattered light. The idea is that since the light comes in and interacts with the atoms according to some Schrödinger's equation, and when the photons are scattered off that system, they carry some correlations with the system variables, such that if I now make measurements on the outgoing light, I can infer something about the evolving quantum variables for this quantum system. And so the formalism gets used, it's mathematically kind of complicated, but it involves, you get a quantum mechanical analog of the theory of stochastic processes and stochastic calculus. You essentially can think of little bits of the quantum field coming in as being like little quantum stochastic increments. These come in sequentially, get entangled with the system, they get scattered off. And now what I can do is say, all right, so I'm going to detect the light as some sort of a detector. And what I'd like to be able to do is do exactly the same kind of filtering thing, but where now, rather than making least squares optimal estimates of things like x and v, in this situation I just have some set of observables on the Hilbert space of this quantum system. And what I would like is some equations that tell me, given that I get a certain measurement signal from my detection of the scattered field, I would be able to construct conditional expectations for all of the variables that I care about in this system. And of course, you may have a very large number of such equations, but in any case, the overall principle is the same. And with the few necessary kinds of approximations in the modeling, you can, again, derive a close set of equations that does this. And in some cases, we've even tested those things out experimentally. So why would you want to do this? Well, in my group, the main thing that we have been concerned about is now quantum mechanical feedback control of quantum dynamical systems. So there are a lot of examples like that. If I just toss out something which is familiar to some people, you can almost think that error correction or stabilization of quantum memories as being a thing of this type. Now, I think most people don't really approach it this way, but you can always imagine that I have some number of atoms sitting in the center of my chamber, and I've encoded some quantum information in something about the state of this quantum system. Now, if I know that there are external perturbations coming in and acting on this thing, what I might like to do is continuously monitor some observables for this system, and then based on what I'm seeing, I might at some point decide to go in and apply a corrective action to try to keep the certain information with the highest possible fidelity.
Are the pies your expectation values?
The pies are conditional expectation. Right? So really what we're saying is that I have some quantum random variable that's an observable that that I ascribe to this system. But then what's going on as a function of time is I keep making these measurements of the scattered field. And so I can in principle describe that as a quantum stochastic process. So then it makes sense to ask something like, well, what is the conditional expectation for this observable, given a sequence of measurement results that I have out of the photodetector? And so that's what the pies really indicate, just at time t, what is my conditional expectation for this observable?
But it's not conditional for you because you've seen the measurements, right? Well, it's not conditional just because it's a general formula that only, no matter what the measurement results are.
It's conditional in the sense that, for instance, what I may have is I may know the Hamiltonian these things are evolving under, and my measurement may tell me something like it might give me a noisy readout of sigma z. But then I might want to say, well, what's my conditional expectation for sigma y? Right? So these things are still conditional expectations.
I think it shows a mathematical form that takes, that initial expectation value. And how you write down that expression, and so it's difficult to do in the abstract.
It's not difficult to do in the abstract. I mean, I didn't prepare a slide on that, but essentially, I was sort of hoping that people are familiar with the concept of. I mean, you can write down a general formula for it, but it's meant to just be the quantum generalization of a unit. Okay, so that given some information, you may have a conditional expectation for any random variable. Okay, so the idea is really that you're meant to think about this slide in as close an analogy as possible to the previous one. Right, where then here, hopefully it was clear that if you just say that, well, this particle has a position and a velocity. Initially, I don't know what it is. You know, I start to get some sensor readout, which is a noisy readout of only one of them, say only the velocity. On the other hand, after I've watched the noisy velocity signal for a while, I actually have a pretty good idea probably what the position is. Right? Like when I see the velocity go through zero, start with something positive and go to something negative, then I know that it's at that turning point or that turning point. Right? Whereas without having observed velocity at all, I mean, I have no idea whatsoever what the position of that particle is. Or maybe I can only localize it somewhere inside this wide region.
Well, in this classical scenario, I would imagine that the information dy gives you a conditional probability distribution. An expectation, which is an expectation of the variable with respect to that conditional probability.
Yeah, sure, so you can think of that.
So quantum mechanically, that a state is conditional on some information, and so it's an expectation value with respect to the state, and that state is conditional on the information?
So you can do that. I mean, the way that it works out mathematically, it's way, way more direct to do all the derivations in the Heisenberg picture. Right? On the other hand, what you can always do is say that, well, suppose that I just know that the Hilbert space for this system has some small dimension. I can write down a quorum of the circles, and by duality, right, I can take these equations and derive instead an evolution equation for a conditional density operator. And so that will give you the more well-known stochastic master equation. But it's actually more direct to do the derivation this way. So sort of do it in the Heisenberg picture first, and then use duality to actually give you an equation for the density matrix instead. But that's the idea, that if I take a trace of pi t of O with respect to the initial state in this Heisenberg picture kind of way, that would be the same thing as taking trace of the conditional density operator times the operator of O. Right, so you really just use that duality. You put it on one side of that thing or the other. Yeah, so there's certainly quantum information kinds of scenarios in which you want to do feedback control on a quantum system. Work that's been going on in my group more recently is actually geared towards precision measurement and sensing. So for example, one of the things that we've recently demonstrated in an experiment is that if this system under question is a bunch of pulled atoms that are using sense magnetic fields, we've shown that there are procedures that look exactly like this. So basically, you take a laser beam, shine it on the atoms. The direction that the atoms of the spins of the atoms are pointing in affects the polarization of the transmitted light beam. So if I detect the transmitted light beam and read out its polarization, I can read off something about the way that the directions of the spins are moving. And so that already, you know, in this adjusting the filtering gives me a way of now sensing magnetic fields based on this kind of a measurement and allows me to describe it rigorously. But then we've also shown that if you want to obtain the highest possible precision in the presence of kind of uncertainty, such as uncertainty in the number of atoms that you actually have, this type of feedback control can be crucial in doing that in terms of giving you ways of doing such sensing that's robust to uncertainties about possible parameters. So as I was mentioning, even in the quantum mechanical case, you can in principle write down the optimal filtering equations if your figure of merit there is a least squares kind of optimality. And that thing in the mathematical physics literature is known as the Lotkin equation. But to somebody from quantum optics or atomic physics, it's the dual of the thing that we call the stochastic master equation. Right, so if you're working in terms of the observables, you have the Lotkin equation. If you work in terms of conditional density matrix, you have the stochastic master equation. Now, some things that we've shown in the context of magnetometry are that, again, if you specialize to kind of a linear quadratic case, you actually, even starting with these quantum equations, you get exactly the classical formalism of Kalman filtering. And so that shows a very direct connection between these types of scenarios and very well established tools in the classical filtering case. And some people in the engineering community, Matt James in particular from ANU, has written some things about robust filtering in the quantum domain, and we've started to play a little bit with the filter reduction. So a lot of the tools that you have in the classical case can be extended to the quantum case. It's just that now you have all this underlying non-commutative stuff that you have to deal with in slightly more mathematical generality.
dynamic, if you have uncertainty about a classical parameter, but you're working with an informal model, then you get sort of hybrid theory. You could, you know, you can work in a picture where it's a Schrodinger equation. If you could have a row that is a block diagonal in your classical parameter, if you have uncertainty about the block.
Yeah, I mean, so the best example of that is like in the magnetometry case. So what we do is we work with, the thing that we're actually trying to infer is how the C component of the magnetization is evolving. And what happens is that you get this laser that comes in, and its polarization gets rotated by some amount that should be proportional to that. But then you've got lots of noise on there, just the vacuum noise of the light that's coming through. On the other hand, if we're doing magnetometry, we also don't know the rate at which this thing is rotating, which is the parameter that appears in the Hamiltonian of these particles. It's a magnetic field. So what you can end up doing is write down a filtering equation that has three different things in it. That has expectation of FC, or sigma z, it has variance of sigma z, and it has the value of the magnetic field. And those things might just appear in there as three things that you don't know. And what the filtering equation does is tell you how to update those in some conditional way as you get more and more filter current. And so classical parameters that you don't happen to know, they can just go, yeah, they can just get sucked into the filtering in some hybrid sort of way. And it's extremely natural to do that. Yeah, so yeah, that's kind of the engineer's point of view on what's going on here. The quantum filtering is really just this business of trying to construct conditional expectations now for quantum random variables rather than classical ones based on the results of making measurements of some sort of scattered field from the quantum system. Right, so it's interesting because really the mathematics that you use here, a lot of it is quantum field theory that has to do with how you do the scattering and how you take a Markov limit for that scattering process. But then all the stuff that happens down here is just that it's an exercise in probability theory. And then the filtering equations that you end up with, however, are very useful things if what you're trying to do are engineering-ish sorts of things like sensing or feedback control of the quantum system. Now, if we then ask instead, though, so why were these kinds of equations derived in the context of atomic physics, where people maybe weren't initially concerned with those kinds of things? People's interests were actually much more along the lines of non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. So probably you're familiar with the general idea of an open quantum system, where suppose I just had some bunch of atoms, again, floating in the middle of my vacuum chamber. If I were able to assume that those things were completely isolated from the rest of the world, we know that you could write down a dynamical equation for those things, which is really just a Schrodinger equation. On the other hand, if we say that there is this laser beam, right, so I'm shining some laser beam on it, and the photons are becoming correlated with the atomic states, and they get scattered away. If I just want to think about this thing now as an open system with some decoherence, and I say, well, I don't actually look at the light that gets scattered away, I just know that this process is happening. Now, if I want to describe the evolution of the state of the particles, I need to use something like a master equation, right, where the thing will evolve according to some Hamiltonian term, but also will have this sort of Lindblad structure with some operators that actually decohere the state of the system. So where the stochastic master equation arises is that if you take exactly this setup, but now you say, rather than just letting this field get scattered off and just escaping to infinity, I collect all of that scattered light and I detect it. Right? So if you're familiar with the usual derivation of the master equation, rather than taking in a little bit of an environmental state, entangling it, and then tracing it out, I bring in some environmental thing, I entangle the two things, and then I project it onto some value that I happen to measure. Then it turns out that you can view that conditioning process actually as a correction to the usual master equation. So if I say that instead of just the terms which are Hamiltonian and purely dissipative terms, I can add on now a sort of conditioning term, where what appears in there is, you know, some number of system operators, the density matrix is there. And what these things are is dyt, that's the measurement signal that you're actually getting in a single run of this experiment. This quantity over here is actually, in each time step, the conditional expectation for what you were expecting to see in the measurement signal at that time step. And if you look at the difference of those two things, those things are actually used to kind of update the state of the system to keep it appropriately consistent with the measurement results that you're getting. So this equation up here is the thing that atomic physics or atomic people would call a stochastic master equation. Now, so you can view it kind of as a generalization of the master equation, and what's interesting about it is that this thing here, that's literally like, if we had a situation in the laboratory, I would take the cable that came out of my photodetector, I would stick it into my circuit, and the circuit would treat that voltage as this quantity dyt. And in evolving the state of the system, you know, numerically, you would treat that thing as a driving term, this stochastic equation. Now, interpretations of what this equation is vary quite widely And I want to emphasize the two different extremes there, because I think we're going to come back to it later on when we look at some examples. So many people in the physics community will look at this equation and say, okay, what this is that rho, this density operator, that's sort of an objective real thing, which is a physical property of the particles that I'm observing. What this equation describes is this is how that state evolves in the absence of measurements on the field. On the other hand, if I'm making measurements of the scattered field, the state of the system evolves in this conditioned way. And so I really think of this as being like a stochastic evolution equation for the physical state, sort of along the same lines as you would use a Langevin equation. On the other hand, from the filtering perspective, you come to believe something different. So really, you know, there's supposed to be this little box down here, which is my filtering device. And this equation is the equation that gets used by that filtering device. And so really the way that I think of this is that rho t in this equation is my filter's estimate of a sufficient statistic for computing conditional expectation values for all of the observables on the system's algebra of observables. And so this quantity, this is the thing that my filter keeps in its electronic head. And so the reason why this stuff appears here is it has a kind of predictor corrector structure. Right, so in every time step, my filtering circuit says, well, here's what I think the state is right now. Let me predict what I think the measurement result should be in the next time step. Let me sort of take the actual measured value and compare them. And if they're very different, I want to make an adjustment to my estimate of the system state as the signal goes along. Right, so really, to an engineer, you think of this thing really as a filtering equation. And so all of these things are meant to be kind of epistemic in nature. And so in particular, you know, when you look at this quantity down here, you can show mathematically that if all your modeling is actually appropriate, that the difference dyt minus this thing, you can show that it's strictly a Gaussian wavelength. And to an engineer, it's a thing called the innovation process. And really what it represents is in every new time step, what's the new information that I'm getting from the signal that came out of my detector? Right? And that new information has to be something that causes you to update your state. Because if this is zero, that's like, well, things are exactly the way that I thought, so there's no new information coming out of my detector. On the other hand, if this quantity is large, that means actually my estimate is way off base, and so I got a lot of important new information out of my detector. What I'll talk about in a little bit is that in the physical, so if you take a quantum optics derivation of this thing, this term tends to get derived directly as a Gaussian wave noise term, and what it really looks like is, say, the shot noise on this optical protofield. And so in the physical derivation, you really tend to think of this thing as a more physical noise term, which is driving the evolution of the state in a more Langevin-like way. But these are two different extremes of interpretation of the equation. But I think some of the examples that I'm going to show you will bias my interpretation anyway, one way or the other. Nonetheless, one of the important things about noting that this thing is a Gaussian white noise is it allows you to take this equation and use it for simulating measurement trajectories. Right? So that you know, in principle, if I know how to write down this equation for some envisioned experimental setup in which I'm continuously observing some quantum dynamics, I can just stick in an appropriately scaled Gaussian white noise here and use that to drive the evolution, the stochastic evolution of a conditional density operator. And in that way, I can sort of simulate, you know, what would the conditional density operator of a system like this, how would it evolve in a typical sort of experimental trial. And that notion is the notion of quantum trajectories or quantum Monte Carlo, which is actually the first way in which this kind of equation was used in physics. Okay, so I mean, to make this connection to nonlinear dynamics, I want to mention some work that was done by Salman Habib and co-workers of Asalamos, which I think now starts to give you an indication for how this sort of tool, this sort of theoretical tool, can be used in contexts that are very far from engineering. And this has to do with trying to understand what are the signatures of dynamical chaos when we're talking about quantum systems. So in classical dynamics, I think you get used to the idea that, you know, the single really rigorous measure of chaos is positively alpha-nothing exponents for a dynamical system. And the problem with trying to apply that measure to quantum systems is you know that if what you use is just really the Schrödinger equation, any two wave functions that I might start out with, their inner product is preserved over the three-dimensional unitary evolution. So those positive alpha-nothing exponents are never going to occur for the actual Schrödinger equation. But of course, the same sort of thing is true if you look classically at the Liouville equation. But if I take two different probability distributions on the base space and evolve them forward according to the Hamiltonian Liouville equation, their overlap is also preserved. So really the problem is in trying to understand, well, if I want to think about a quantum state as being like a probability distribution, what are the signatures going to be of the fact that the trajectories that underlie the evolution of that distribution actually have some sort of exponential divergence? So the system that Habib and coworkers, one of the systems that Habib and coworkers have looked at is the quantum Duffing oscillator, which we define by we just give ourselves a Hamiltonian like this, with this extra little driving term. And then we say that we're going to implement a continuous position measurement, which is what this term does. But here's the stochastic master equation for the quantum Duffing oscillator subject to continuous position measurement. And k here is a parameter that stands for the strength of the measurement. And so, it's kind of a scattering picture, right? Obviously, I can tune the strength of the measurement from zero up to something very large, either by changing the power of the optical beam that I'm scattering off of these atoms to make a measurement, or by changing the frequency of this thing from something that is quasi-resonant with the system to something that's just very far away from the system. So some things that are shown here. Here, for example, if we just say that, let's just look at the localization of x, right? So if we, the localization of x for the system under a very weak measurement, so if we're hardly measuring the thing at all, right, after we sit there and let the thing evolve, the wave function is going to spread around all over the place. And so if I look at the marginal distribution for x, in a case with weak or no measurement, you get this red distribution, where x is highly, highly delocalized. Right? So clearly, you can't really think that there's a trajectory sitting under there. And then again, for some, I believe, a scaled measurement strength of 1, after you've let the thing evolve for a while, the measurement is strong enough to keep localizing the wave function of this thing. Because even though the dynamics might be wanting to spread the wave packet out, if I'm continuously measuring what x is, that measurement keeps the evolution of the wave packet into some sort of positive trajectory. And so in green is just showing you that sort of thing actually occurs if you simulate this thing in a way. Likewise, if we do something like a Poincaré section on this sort of system, so just on an x and p phase space, these two plots up here are what you get if you evolve this thing for a while under very, very weak measurement. And what you just see is, you just get some kind of meaningless smear that doesn't have any apparent relation to the classical phase portrait. And if you make the measurement way too strong, you get this this plot down here, which doesn't really have any structure in it at all. So here's an example where your measurement actually dominates the intrinsic nonlinear dynamics of the system. And again, you don't really see anything interesting. However, the claim is, and I'm not an expert on this to really argue why, is that if you look for appropriately intermediate values of the measurement strength, you can identify structures in this kind of Poincaré map that are very similar to things that you would see for the classical system that didn't have any measurement diffraction or wave packet spreading or anything like that. So the idea here is just that if you tune the measurement strength appropriately, and they actually also have to tune the value of h-bar to get themselves into sort of a semi-classical regime, the idea is that in this filtering sort of picture, what you could do is say, well, let's imagine that I have this physical system, and it's evolving, and I just have some continuous sort of weak readout of the position of this thing. Well, then what I have is putative a measurement signal of x as a function of time. And now in a classical chaotic scenario, you know that even if I give you a noisy measurement of x as a function of time, there are time series reconstruction methods that can be used on that signal to try to estimate what the output of exponents of that system. Right? So for instance, if I take a classical Duffing oscillator, I simulate the thing, I take its instantaneous position measurement, add a small random variable to it, and just construct it along the time series that way. There are well-known and robust techniques for taking that time series and estimating it from it, the Lyapunov exponents, which you can verify from some other kind of independent calculation. And the claim of Habib et al. Is that even if you do this now with a stochastic master equation, right, with a tweaked but still non-zero value of h-bar, and for an appropriate value of the measurement strength, you can do the same sort of time series reconstruction and pull out a Lyapunov exponent, which is the same as the classical one for the Duffing oscillator in the same parameter regime.
See, in the classical case, you have a deterministic evolution in phase space. Mm-hmm. So this Poincaré map is well defined.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is what you're showing us here just one particular realization of this stochastic process on average over? And what is, how is this Poincaré map defined in this case?
Maybe that it's a single long trajectory, or maybe that they actually average over a few. I'm actually not sure. I know that in the other sorts of work, they do average over some number of trajectories, and there are error bars on quantities that indicate this sort of variation. So I would say, I'm not sure about the Poincaré map, but when it comes to the calculation off of the Lyapunov exponents, they did average over some number of trajectories pretty times. But I think it's a very interesting result to say that you can take this very quantum mechanical equation, and just by you know that the system, isolated systems, does not want to localize on trajectories. The only thing that you have is the wave function. It spreads all over the place. And so there's really no meaningful way to talk about Bayesian vectors. On the other hand, the claim of these authors is that if you ask, what would happen if I actually had a very weak position measurement on, and where I tuned the strength of that measurement exactly so that it localizes the trajectory enough, but the back action isn't so strong that it overwhelms the intrinsic dynamics. The claim is that from such time series, you can actually recover the classical Lyapunov exponents. So those classical Lyapunov exponents are actually buried somewhere in these quantum evolution sections. So, I mean, I think that's a very interesting claim. It's not entirely clear how you should interpret the situation because they have the two things. On the other hand, it really tells you that, well, maybe there's something some interesting insight that we can get about quantum classical correspondence if we look at these sorts of nonlinear dynamics and use the tools that we get from quantum filtering.
I don't know if it's an important point, but I didn't understand what it meant to tune H perhaps. And this is just some system you cooked up anyway. It's not any definite physical system. So what does it mean to tune H perhaps?
I think for even classical models, the sequence of quantum models also seem with different dimensionalities in Hilbert space. Which is so normally each bar would be one of the dimensions of Hilbert space. If it's a bi-dimensional system, for example. Otherwise, it's the ratio of the effective action derived from the parameters of the Hamiltonian to H bar, and so you can go to increasingly large mass scales. It's like increasing H bar.
Yeah. I think the thing that matters of mattering in the end is the ratio of the product of K and H bar. So that's the thing that they have to tune. But then if you want to relate that to something that would be a realistic experimental system, you find that they have to go to some value of values of K and H bar that aren't completely realistic. On the other hand, formally you could say that you get these results in the equation.
The point is that on the scale of this graph, the quantum cell phase rate is very, very small.
That's true, yeah. These kinds of things, are kind of going on concurrently with the work that I'm going to tell you about tomorrow. But I think, together they paint some sort of interesting picture, I think, for using these quantum measurement perspectives for a new approach to understanding quantum chaos. Okay, so the system that I'm going to focus on for the rest of the talk is now an experimentally realistic system, although the results that I'm going to show you are still computational results. But I want to spend just a couple of slides talking about what this physical system is, and then towards the end of the talk, I'll show you some experimental progress on trying to do these things actually in the laboratory. So, cavity QED, so this is an optical cavity QED. This is an experimental paradigm that I think was really pioneered by Jeff Kimball. Recently, people like Gerhard Renpa and Mike Kaplan, James Tamperker, and others have joined into this field. I think it's going to start making very rapid progress over the next few years. So the physical system that we consider is a single two-level atom coupled to a single-mode optical field inside a Gerhard-Hennis optical resonator. And so historically, the way that you make these things is you get two extremely good mirrors, place them close together. The mirrors have extremely high reflectivity, so that the storage time of the single photon inside there is very long. And also, you make the overall volume of the cavity pretty small, so that the photon is confined to a very small volume of space. So then if you also introduce a single cesium atom in there, you get a very strong interaction between a single atom and a single photon, which is the condition that we call strong coupling. And in particular, you can write down sort of a matrix element of the interaction Hamiltonian between a single atom and a single photon called that G. And that sort of characterizes the strength of the coherent coupling. You can compare that to dissipative processes which go on, such as spontaneous emission by the atom, just kicking photons out inside of the cavity, and leakage of photons out of this cavity, which we'll call kappa. And so strong coupling is characterized by having a ratio where G is much larger than hydrogen or kappa. So the quantum part of the evolution is really stronger than the dissipative part. An interesting way to characterize that is in terms of some dimensionless parameters. So traditionally, we define a critical photon number, which is gamma squared over 2g squared. So in strong coupling regime, it's less than 1. And really, what this measures is it's the number of photons that you have inside the cavity before the response of the system becomes nonlinear. Right? So in strong coupling regime, you're really doing nonlinear optics with single photons. And this is a condition which can be very well achieved in experiments. There's a complementary parameter called the critical atom number, And this is again a ratio of dissipated rates to the coherent rate. In the strong coupling machine, this is much less than one. And this is a measure of, like, if we view this overall device as sort of an optical input output device, so I can shine some light in one side and take a look at what comes out the other side. If the critical atom number is less than one, it means that the presence or absence of a single atom in between these two mirrors has a huge influence on the intensity and the tuning and phase of the intensity and the phase of the light that comes out the other side. And so in the strong coupling regime, we do nonlinear optics with single photons, and you can switch the transmission of an optical cavity using the state of a single atom. So this sort of physical model is very well studied. And in particular, we have very high confidence in writing down some pretty simple equations. So if we write just down the master equation for the Dirichlet coming Hamiltonian, we can write down a thing that looks like this. So there's a Hamiltonian, which describes things like, well, E here is the strength of the driving field that we shine into the cavity. H bar G, here's that coupling parameter between the atom and the cavity field. And so you can see that that multiplies terms that look like sigma A dagger. So what this thing does is it creates a photon in the cavity and lowers the atom from its excited state to the ground state. So this term just means that I have an excited state atom, which gives up its energy to the cavity by creating a photon. And this is the opposite process where you can absorb a photon into the cavity and excite the atom. And so the overall rate in which that process happens is this kind of G thing. And there are some things that we can use to account for the tunings. So if the frequency of the drive laser is different from either the cavity resonance frequency and or the resonant frequency of the atom, we can put those sorts of parameters in like this. And then these superoperators here just stand for the usual sort of Lindblad structure, where this term accounts for leakage of photons out of the cavity, and this term here accounts for the spontaneous emission by the atom.
Question? Okay. You already assume that this so-called rotating wave approximation is done, so you neglect the terms like A sigma.
Yep. Which is very realistic for optical cavity tuning.
For small tunings, yes.
The energy difference between the ground and the excited state is some 10 to the 15 hertz, mm-hmm. and all of the other rates are not larger than 10 to the 10, let's say.
But then the system in this approximation is integrable, there's no chaos in it.
Correct. Well, yeah, I mean, defined in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, in fact, what I'm going to do is, so I should have mentioned probably, but rather than trying to immediately look at chaos, well, I'll look into it in a second. Really here, rather than looking at chaos, what we want to do is start by trying to understand a simple nonlinear phenomena, mm-hmm. and we won't understand bifurcations that occur in the system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so an important bit of history is to note that even though you can write down those quantum equations, the first way in which this sort of physical model was studied was actually in terms of the semi-classical model. And a way that you can do that is you can say, well, in that previous master equation, the operators that we care about are the annihilation and creation operators for the field, the dipole operator for the atom, and also a population of the population inversion of the atom, which is related to sigma z. So if what we do is we take this previous equation and sort of, obviously having a master equation like this, we can write down instead Heisenberg equations for the operators. If we then go and just take expectation value, so we go to a mean field kind of limit for that dynamics, and then just take the mean value of A, call it X, take the mean value of sigma, call it P, take the mean value of sigma Z, call it M. And then if we just forcibly do this kind of factorization, so this really, if you think about it, this is just a strict moment closure. So we just truncate moments higher than first. So it's really just a brute force mean field approximation. If you do that, then the original Heisenberg equations of motion turn into these things called the Maxwell Block equations, which are closely related to the Lorentz model, which of course is sort of exhaustively studied in classical mechanical systems. So these are the equations that describe, for instance, how the laser works. They're equations that were studied very much back in the 70s and 80s for the state of optical possibility. And people at one point thought that you could use optical possibility effects for doing optical computing. But anyway, so these sorts of the behavior of this sort of model is really very well understood. And now, an interesting thing is that, well, suppose that we don't just want to do this only at a mathematical level, but we want to understand, are there real experimental settings in which these equations are a very good description of the dynamics? And it's, you can show in various ways that if we have a cavity QED situation, and where we don't have a single atom coupled to the field, so we don't have a single strongly coupled atom, but what we have instead is many weakly coupled atoms, you can show that there's a system size expansion in which you can show that this appears as the leading order description of the dynamics. Right, so if there's a strong coupling between the light and the atoms, but that's not now one strongly coupled atom, but instead it's many weakly coupled atoms, then this emerges as a leading order description of the dynamics. On the other hand, you can always match up the two different situations. So there will be one limit, which is a single atom limit, which is highly quantum. There will be this other kind of semi-classical limit, which involves many atoms. So the point of comparison is this thing called the cooperativity parameter, where if I have n atoms in the cavity, and g is the coupling per atom, and then kappa and gamma are again the dissipative rates. So if I just say c is this thing, well, I can either go into the semi-classical regime by saying that n is large and g is small, or I can go into the quantum regime by saying that n is 1 and g is large. Right. So it's an interesting thing because now it's letting us get into a situation where we can compare things like input-output relations and really go to either a strictly quantum level of limit of the dynamics or a more semi-classical limit. So interesting thing that you can then sort of think about are, well, it's known for a long time that if you look at this sort of system as an input-output system, and you look at it in a semi-classical limit, where you have Maxwell block equations, you can easily find parameters in which there is possibility, and where there are corresponding some sound equations. So here what I'm plotting is this is a steady-state input-output relation. So what's on the bottom axis is the power of the light which I'm dropping into the cavity, and on the y-axis is essentially the power of the light that comes out the other side of the cavity. And this curve is showing you the equilibrium values according to the Maxwell block equations. So what it says is that when the driving field is very low, we get a very low output of light out the cavity. As I increase it, I'll stay on this curve here. But then when I get to a certain critical switching point, I'll suddenly hop up to this higher branch. If I keep increasing it, I'll stay up there. If I now start to lower the in a historic way, I'll stay up here on this upper stable branch until I get to a critical lower turning point, and then all of a sudden the transmission will drop back to a lower one. Okay, so the idea is that for driving strengths in this regime, you actually have three equilibrium points, two of which are stable and one of which is unstable. And so it's a nice example here where now this is a semi-classical system, but we get a very nonlinear feature because we've got two bifurcations present and we have multiple equilibria. And we can expect there to be switching dynamics when we get rid of the state dynamics. But now the question is, what's supposed to happen where in those Maxwell block equations, the parameter that really matters is this overall cooperativity. Now, if we say that cooperativity is actually entirely contributed by one atom rather than by a bunch of atoms, we'll go into this quantum regime where we know that this type of a curve still describes the mean behavior of the operators. On the other hand, the quantum fluctuations should really be a very significant thing. So over here, when we have many atoms, we can say that, well, these field intensities are things like the mean values of annihilation and creation operators. But then, of course, they also have some vacuum fluctuations. And so as long as the vacuum fluctuations are small on the overall scale of separation of the different steady states, you might imagine that the mean field description is still a very good description, and it gives you all of the qualitative behavior. On the other hand, what you can show is that in the single atom limit, this same type of bistable structure occurs. However, it occurs for a much lower mean photon number. Right? So then if you say that if the mean photon number is n, the scale of the quantum fluctuations is going to be square root of n. So if this stuff happens at a small mean photon number, then the quantum fluctuations can be large on the scale of the steady-state structure. And so it's not clear whether you should still expect to see any signatures about multi-stability or hysteresis or bifurcations or anything like that. And so what we'd like to do now is develop some way of really looking at the difference between these two limits and trying to understand the kind of classical crush pumps that happens as we go into the same possible limit. So I think the first really interesting thing that we were able to compute in this is that realizing that you have this correspondence, you can use the Maxwell block equations to identify values of these kind of macroscopic parameters where you expect to get this sort of this flexibility. However, we can first go back and numerically solve the unconditional Lenster equation. This is just describing the kind of open system dynamics of this thing and ask, what is the quantum system, what are the solutions of the quantum equations look like in the single atom limit, then for parameter regimes where semi-classically you would have, say, a flexibility. And so you find interesting things where here, so this is the point at which this thing over here is a plot of the Q function for the intercavity field. And what it shows is that if you go to driving conditions that are here, so semi-classically, you would actually be above the upper turning point. So it would be in a place where you were monostable. On the other hand, if we solve the master equation there, we find that the intercavity field actually is cleanly double peaked. right? So the sharing is in the quantum case, even when you're deriving parameters, say that you got to be here, the quantum fluctuations have to somehow kind of explore the rest of the phase space. They understand the fact that there is an equilibrium point nearby at this very different cavity photon number. And so if you look at the kind of steady state distribution of photon number in the cavity, you have two peaks, one of which occurs at a low photon number down here, and another one occurs at a high photon number up there. So it's interesting to ask what that means. I mean, so this is a stationary distribution. It's interesting to note that this calculation that we've done is the first time that people, I believe it's the first time anyone has shown that this that there is this sort of a signature of optical oscillability in this extremely quantum regime. Now, Jeff Kimball and some people who were in his group just after I left, they actually did an experiment which was looking at dynamics in this kind of regime. But what they did was they set a certain input power, and they expected the average output power on the detector. And what they showed was that as you do exactly this kind of thing where you keep gradually increasing the drive power, the amount that occurred would look like this, which was not quite stable at all. I mean, it was just a single value thing. So this dotted line here is the solution of the semi-classical Maxwell block equations. But you can kind of see what happened is that if you just drive the cavity and then detect the average power without any attention to the time scales, even if the stationary distribution is double peaked like this, essentially what you'll do is you'll just detect the average value of the photon number which is happening between these two peaks. So I mean, experiments can be done in a regime which is very much like this, but now if you want to see these signatures, you have to pay attention to the way that you do the detection. So rather than just looking at something simple like the average power transmitted through the cavity, what are you going to expect? Well, you might hope that if you did this and looked at the signal in a time-resolved way, so you kind of think more about this filtering perspective, you actually ought to be able to see the fact that the cavity will sit at a low photon number for a while, hop to a higher one, sit there for a while, and then hop back. If you average over that hopping, you'll just get some boring thing like this. On the other hand, you might hope that if you actually did that experiment and time resolved it, you'd be able to see the kind of actual switching behavior even in a single atom. So what's shown here now, so this is now using this Kapsack-Nostra equation as a simulation tool. And it's showing what you expect to see for the typical measurement trajectories at three different points on the sine. So down here, with the driving strength of tan, this is something where you're right in the middle of the bistable region semi-classically. And what you expect to see for the amplitude of the transmitted field is in fact that it mostly localizes on one of the semi-classical fixed points, but occasionally jumps up and sits on the other one and comes back down. If you go up at a higher driving field, at a driving field of 11.3, that's this guy here. And this is something which I guess you would more clearly expect for something that was bistable. Right, so the transmitted light power seems to localize around two different values, one of which is very low, corresponding to the lower branch of the bistability curve, and the other one of which is relatively high, corresponding to that upper one. Right, so what it says is that in sort of a dynamical picture, the atom cavity system just kind of hops back and forth, more or less executes quantum jumps between what would be like equilibrium points on the semi-classical phase portrait. And then if you increase the driving strength a little bit more, you get something which actually tends to localize mostly in the upper branch and only every once in a while goes down to the lower one. And so if you went even higher, you basically always sit up there at the top. So some interesting questions that arise are, well, I mean, qualitatively, this is perhaps not so surprising. I mean, what it says is that the time-dependent quantum dynamics retains a memory of what the equilibrium solutions are to the mean field equations. On the other hand, the quantum fluctuations cause it to explore one and sort of jump back and forth. There's some kind of weird things, like in the sense that right when you're in the middle of the bistability curve, the system actually seems to have a preference for the lower equilibrium point. Right, so there's sort of a differential stability of those two things. And what would be really nice is if we can now, after seeing this phenomenology, and if we can verify it experimentally, to try to come up with some understanding of why is this node more stable than the other one, give some kind of physical explanation. It would also be nice to get some better understanding of what it means to make the intuitive statement that the quantum fluctuations explore the phase portrait and therefore cause the system to jump around among what would have been equilibrium solutions in the mean field equations. And this differential stability you can see in Kimball's experimental data right here at the bottom. It's a little bit complicated because that's the box here. But I think if you go in here, in that bistable region, it really looks like the system spends most of its time down on the bottom, and only above the upper switching point does it start to come up and then agree with that upper branch. So you can see even more interesting things, right? So if you go back to the Maxwell's block equations and just systematically search for interesting kinds of bifurcations, Here's a picture of what's called a supercritical Hopf aggregation. So this is the same kind of stability diagram, and what you see here is that you increase the driving strength of power coming into the cavity, and for a while we have a well-defined fixed point. So the amount of light that comes out the backside is some fixed value. But then at some point that fixed point becomes unstable, and it is smoothly replaced by a stable limit cycle. So semi-classically, like rather than seeing a constant level of transmission, you should eventually pick up a very small oscillation, which then gets a larger and larger amplitude as you increase the driving strength. But then if you increase the driving strength too far, that thing shrinks back down again and you return to a simple fixed point. So if you go somewhere in there, right, so we pick this point. Again, this is the condition where in the single atom limit, this corresponds to an intercavity function number of only 20. Right, so square root of 20 is pretty big compared to 20, so this is a civilian in a quantum regime. But if you again go and solve for the steady-state Q function, the intercavity field, you get this nice ring-shaped thing, which really suggests that the quantum equations remember the fact that there's supposed to be a stable limit cycle there. And again, you can go and say, well, really, if we looked at a continuous measurement model, you would hope that you could realize the fact that, if you just look at that Q function, it could be anything. It could be that, the actual state of the system was just a Gaussian that randomly diffused around a ring-shaped pattern. But what you would really like is that for classical correspondence, it actually is a periodic orbit, so that there's some coherence to the oscillation in the system around this ring. And so in fact, if you go and simulate the stochastic master equation for a while, you find that it does indeed oscillate. And there's some variation in the amplitude of that oscillation, and also it undergoes some phase diffusion. But it really is the case that even in the single atom limit, the system remembers the fact that there's supposed to be a stable limit cycle. And some kind of strange things happen. Well, so first of all, you can go through and you can calculate either from the master equation or the stochastic master equation what the correlation function of the system looks like. And so you find that it is true that the quantum fluctuations tend to dephase the periodic orbit. And so in the absence of any noise, you would expect this periodic orbit to have perfect phase coherence. But in the quantum model, the vacuum fluctuations actually cause that oscillation to dephase over time. And so it'd be very nice to understand exactly what sets the time scale of that phasing. Also, there are some weird kind of properties where, again, if this is the solution of the semi-classical equation, so that the oscillations kind of turn on and they remain large for a while and then they eventually go away, the phase coherence time that you see in the quantum model actually does something which is quite different than that. Right, so the phase coherence actually dives down at a point which is well before that limit cycle was supposed to appear. It's a disappear semi-classical. And so again, I think there are all kinds of interesting things you can ask for in terms of the correspondence between the quantum and semi-classical dynamical. And finally, you get some really interesting sorts of things like that. So here's an instance of the subcritical Hopf application. So that's the sort of thing where you change the driving parameter, you have some nice fixed point, and at some point, all of a sudden, the local equilibrium completely disappears. So then at that point, the system has to jump somewhere very far away in the phase structure to find another attractor. And so we found that sort of a Hopf application. And if you sit at that point and calculate what the steady state Q function looks like, it again has a ring-shaped thing, suggesting there's a limit cycle that it's attracted to. But there's also a more Gaussian sort of hump that's sitting there as well. And so this is something that I'd like to look at further, because I think the fact that the Q function is not strictly symmetric around the intersection of that hump with the ring suggests that this may even be a coherent superposition, so that you might actually be able to show that there's some quantum coherence between the fixed point that evidently sits here and the limit cycle that evidently sits there. And that would be an interesting thing to study in this constant limit. Now again, if you go and do quantum sort of stochastic master equation simulations of this thing, you find some behavior like this, where most of the time the system is sitting there on that limit cycle oscillating. But every once in a while, it'll go through a period where it's really very quiet. And that looks like one in which it sort of jumped to this fixed point solution and sat there. And then it jumps back off and is doing this sort of oscillation. So this is sort of an overview of the different kinds of nonlinear structures that we believe we should be able to see in this single atom cavity QPD. And I think it's an important thing to study because, again, it'll be the first system that I know of which you could really go into. It's clearly in a quantum mechanical limit, so you've just got one atom and say 10 photons, something like that. Dynamically, it has these very clear signatures of nonlinear dynamics, and it has multiple equilibrium solutions, and then it's also doing something very quantum, which is executing quantum jumps among the fixed points. And so we've done a lot of simulations of these things numerically. We think we understand how to deal with them, and the trick is going to be to go and do an experiment. Let's talk about this. I mean, there's another kind of application that we've looked at more exhaustively in the past, where in addition to just being able to do numerical simulations of this thing, you can go in and make physical interpretations of what the modeling looks like. And you can sort of understand something about the fact that these switching events, in this particular case, are actually caused by individual spontaneous emissions by the atom. So you can kind of see exactly where the quantum jumps come from. It would be great to have this kind of a clean interpretation in the case of those other non-linearities. Well, then just close with 1 or 2 minutes of showing you what the experiments look like. And that will make a final point of the fact that this is not just a basic science interest, but I think understanding these things is going to be very important, actually, for the future of nanotechnology. So a few minutes. So this work that was done in the 80s, 90s, and until the current day in optical cavity QED by groups like Jeff Kimball's, which involved these sort of Fabry-Perot cavities, where each one of these bullet-shaped things is actually a piece of glass with dimensions on the order of millimeters. There's this very, very small gap between the two mirrors, of say 10 and 10 microns. And then what you have to do is bring a single atom into the space between those two mirrors, and that's how you get your cavity QED happen. So you're very deep in the strong coupling regime here, so that the critical photon numbers are about 10 to the minus 4, critical atom numbers are like 10 to the minus 3, and the projections by this sort of system you have to be able to do even better. But you know, the thing's kind of macroscopic, and all the rates that you have here tend to be on a scale of about 100 megahertz. On the other hand, what our group has been working on experimentally in collaboration with Axel Scherer and Oscar Painter is to replace these rather macroscopic cavities with nanofabricated things like photonic bandgap structures. So this is showing you an electron micrograph of a piece of semiconductor that we've built some holes into. And this single defect in this lattice of holes actually can serve as an optical microcavity that can trap a single photon there. And if you can somehow get an atom to interact with that under the quantum dot, the projections are that you can get critical photon numbers on here 10 to the minus 8 and critical atom numbers still on the order of 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 4. So you ought to be able to do strength from coupling cavity QED with these things. The difference being that the characteristic rates for this sort of thing, since they're so much smaller, now get up to the level of 10 to gigahertz. So the speeds would be really very, very much greater. So the different sorts of systems that we're trying to construct, here's an example of something where this is showing you a piece of a chip that's been kind of lithographically fabricated. So it's a piece of sapphire that we printed gold wires onto. And in fact, if you run currents through these gold wires, you get very localized magnetic fields. And we and other people have managed to show that you can actually hang on to laser-cooled atoms using those inhomogeneous magnetic fields from these wire patterns and sort of move atoms around on this chip. And what we're trying to do is construct something where this this piece of semiconductor right there would be one of these photonic bandgap structures coupled to an optical fiber. So then we really could do exactly the kinds of experiments that I talked about empirically in sort of a chip-like design. There's also been some very interesting progress by several groups out there where rather than using atoms to do the cavity QED, they're starting to show progress where it's actually using semiconductor quantum dots to do this, so that you can do the whole thing in just a single monolithic structure, although here these things aren't being perfected. But the final conclusion is really just to say that if we think about this photonic bandgap structure, so we think about this nanofabricated implementation of cavity QED, especially actually using quantum dots, you can just look at some very raw parameters. So one of which is, you know, these sorts of switching structures that I was talking about, like the observed by stability, the overall scale of this switching is some tens of photons. If you calculate what that energy is, that's about 10 to the minus 18 joules in switching energy. The overall rates that we'd be talking about if we go to these finite bandgap structure quantum dot systems is like tens of gigahertz. Right, so now you're trying to get into picosecond switching with attojoule switching energies. And this is exactly where the semiconductor industry wants to go for its generation of computing technology between CMOS and something, say, quantum computing. And I think all of them want to do this, so they want to make their systems very reversible. They want to have very small energy dissipation, and they want to have very fast switching. And many of them are starting to think that using optical systems is the natural way to go in order to get to these scales. However, when you start to think about these things, and when you're down at nanojoules and gigahertz, you kind of necessarily have to think about the fact that there are quantum fluctuations in all the in the sort of the states of everything that you're going to use for these computing devices. So we're actually very much convinced that if you want to go to this design regime for sort of engineering classical computing technology, you really have to come to terms with the way that the quantum fluctuations interact with the nonlinear dynamics that are the sort of intrinsic physical effects that you're going to rely on for things like switching and latching. So in addition to this, all of this business being interesting from the perspective of understanding quantum classical correspondence, I think you have to understand it and you have to understand how to engineer it in order to do things in really very practical systems. So that's the end of my time. So
questions? I'll start with one. Harry, going back to the very beginning of the talk, you mentioned that you could, by doing the feedback control, get an idea of the dynamics of the system. So actually, in the quantum case, that's true as well. So you could model the noise to some extent by data. So my question is, how well do you expect to model the noise? And I'm wondering if in particular, whether you can find anomalous sources of decoherence using these kinds of techniques.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it basically, so, right, so in the classical scenario, right, there's a very well, so often what happens is if you have a system like this, you have some signal coming out, and you're trying to filter it, and in addition to identifying variables, you also want to get parameters that turn that Hamiltonian. And so there's a whole field called system identification, which is a description of how you do that. Sometimes you know that there's an issue where if you just let the dynamics evolve on its own, because of the partial nature of your observation, there are certain parameters that you're actually not sensitive to. So then what you can do is talk about closed-loop system identification, where what you do is, as your estimates of the model parameters are converging, you actually start to drive the thing in a different way, or kick it in some way that gives you more information in your fixed output channel about the parameters that you really want to know. And so that sort of thing certainly does apply in this case. Right. And so the open loop thing where you don't have any feedback, what you want to do is identify the Hamiltonian or the state of terms. So you want to model yourself with coherence. Me and other people have written a lot of papers about how you do that. And what's just starting to be done are people starting to consider now the closed loop case, where if there are certain parameters that you don't find out about very well, given this particular measurement that you have, you can actually tweak the dynamics of the system in a way that exposes those parameters more effectively.
If you want to convince people that the right way to interpret stochastic mass equation is not as, you know, the physical state of the system evolving, then it would be nice, for instance, to show that collapse theories are ruled out. Because people who believe in collapse theories would take that sort of picture. And so it seems to me that you're saying, you know, there's a possibility, whereas the standard wisdom is very hard to test the collapse theory because the difference between the, you know, decoherence that's evolved by these intrinsic collapses and just regular decoherence is hard to see. Mm-hmm. If you've got some large system and you monitor for a large period of time, then maybe you can tweak the parameters so that you can actually tell if there's any anomalous decoherence or not.
That would be interesting to talk about that. I don't know enough about the collapse theories to say that. I mean, let me just quickly describe this situation. So here, what you get is, this is showing you the steady state Q function for the field inside the cavity. So basically what happens is that there are kind of like coherent states, but that sit on different phase values for the field. And what you can show by a more detailed analysis of the model is that what the system actually does, so here's a simulation of what the photocurrent looks like if you're measuring a phase. So the cavity field will localize on one phase for a while, and then just randomly it'll switch and have the other phase. So for a while, then switch back, and then switch back. And when you go and poke around in the model, you can show that these switching events are actually caused by individual spontaneous emission events by the atom. So it's kind of funny, though, is that if you think about the stochastic mass equation for the system, what noise is in there? The only noise that's in there is the innovations process noise. Right? So essentially, it's the difference between what you're reading in the photocurrent and what you expect to read in the photocurrent. So that's the only noise that drives the equation. And yet somehow this thing knows that it should every once in a while undergo a discrete transition. Now, if you follow the quantum optics derivation of this equation, what you can show is that the photocurrent that you get should be the sum of a conditional expectation for the phase of the cavity field, plus the Gaussian-Moid noise term. And you can actually show that these switching events occur when your Gaussian-Moid noise realization of your shot noise sits to one side of zero and the other for kind of an anomalous period of time. Right, so here, this is just plotting what the random toss was for the shot noise. And when it sits on one side for a little while, it actually causes the atom to switch states. So if you take the standard physics interpretation of this thing, where what you do is you just interpret that the noise that comes out of this thing is just shot noise on the field, you get this weird thing where it looks like the shot noise of the local oscillator in the measurement, which has never interacted with the system, causes the atom to undergo a spontaneous emission event, which makes no sense whatsoever. On the other hand, if you interpret these things as innovations, it's really quite simple, because it just says that, well, when your measurement readings sit to one side of, they're biased in one direction, that means that your current estimate is probably wrong. So your estimate of the system state should actually change to correct itself. And so it's quite natural that that would be what happens to influence the state. So, I mean, there are these kinds of interpretational things that you get out of those sorts of equations. It'd be interesting to go outside the realm of more standard interpretations of the measurement theory and see what it says about those.
When you calculate the probability distributions for the points on the hysteresis curves, do you find hysteresis in the probability distributions themselves, or are completely determined by the energy differential?
Yeah, I mean, so those things are really stationary asymptotically stable solutions. So yeah, there's no hysteresis in them.
And this system identification example you're talking about, where they actually drive the system to different parameter regimes or different base regimes to sample the parameters better. Is that a problem arise if the system's chaotic?
It presumably wouldn't. Right?
Yeah, so I mean, if you sample everything pretty uniformly.
Yeah, I mean, you can just sort of, you can characterize the whole observability thing in terms of leap brackets. So it's basically, you have some observables that you want, and in a Heisenberg picture, those things evolve by bracketing. And so if your Hamiltonian is such that you mix all the things that you want to see into the observable that you happen to be measuring, then everything's fine. In fact, so you don't need anything like chaos. You just need this much milder condition, which an engineer would call full observability. But it essentially comes down to commutative between Hamiltonian and some set of observables that you care about.
This is a question about something confusing me at a very general level. It's not specifically with your talk, but you mentioned a couple of times how the Heisenberg picture is more useful in some of the calculations. But if I understand in this kind of evolution, since it's not unitary, this so-called Heisenberg evolution won't preserve the commutators of the algorithm, Q and P, for example, or whatever.
Right.
So what, you must exactly, how does one interpret that? It's not a very well-known question, but can you comment on that?
Yeah, so in this picture, you actually do, when you do the derivations, you have something which is overall unitary. So the situation that you start with, you write down, operators on some atom or set of atoms, mm-hmm. and then you write down a multimodal quantum field for this field that you're scattering. And then you essentially write down a Hamiltonian that corresponds to Maxwell's equations. And so what you could do in principle is just evolve the unitary Schrödinger equation forward in time, and you would get something. But it would be a giant mess, because in order to track it, you actually have to keep track of, Heisenberg picture, sort of infinite number of different operators in the field, or in Schrödinger picture, this really, really infinite thing. So what you do instead is you start from that completely unitary situation, and the first thing that you do is make what's called a Markov approximation, where rather than thinking about this thing as a multimodal field, you think of it as a sequence of little field increments that come in and sequentially interact. So you have a little field increment that comes in, gets entangled with the system, and then flies away, and then you detect it. And that transition is done by, most people do it by using this so-called Van Hove limit, which is something that comes from kinetic matter theory, and it's a kind of perturbation theory. But so after you've done that, I now say, well, what is the evolution that's induced on the system alone? That becomes non-unitary and stochastic. But
that non-unitary and stochastic evolution, does it have a dual description in terms of the operators, or is it only now described in terms of the density matrix?
You can do either, right?
So in terms of the operators, it'll then be a non-unitary evolution for the operators.
It's a stochastic unitary evolution.
Stochastic unitary.
So you can still write that.
What
is
that?
It means that
are the commutation relations among the operators preserved or not preserved?
They are preserved. The commutation.
Well, it has to be unitary.
The commutation relations among the field output operators are preserved, but the computation relations among the system operators can change. It's the sort of thing where if you have an operator at time zero, the way that you find it at time t is just you conjugate it by some property error.
That's what I think. What always confuses me is interpretation of those system ones, which are not comparing the usual commutation relations. If you think of measuring them at some later time, how do you interpret that? Because then, they're not the operators you think they're. Particularly, they're not obeying the same algebra.
Well, the thing is that, I mean, you never directly measure those observables, right? What you do is you measure the scattered field, and then you make inferences about those operators, which is a very important distinction. But I would claim that in a realistic physical setup, that's the way it actually goes.
So you're saying whatever you measure is always is being interpreted to the model?
The things that you measure always have the kind of causal computation properties that you want them to. I mean, the dynamics is not trivial, but. Yeah, and I mean, because if you look at what's happening here, right, so those operators evolve according to some standard propagator type of rule. However, that propagator evolves according to some equation that involves these stochastic field operators. Yeah, but I mean, at the end of the day, you get something which is entirely equivalent to just saying that you have a density operator that evolves in some stochastic way.
So, if you have more questions for today, please be here today and tomorrow in room 355. So, let's thank you again.